Hi, good afternoon, and thank you all for coming here on this snowy day to talk about neglected tropical diseases, which might seem a bit remote under this current weather. We're thrilled today to have with us Governor Tommy Thompson as our lead speaker here on the work that he's undertaken as the global ambassador for the Global Network to Fight Neglected Tropical Diseases, and we're also delighted that we're joined by his colleague, Peter Hotez, from George Washington University and the Sabin Institute there, who's played a key role. There's a Peter and Tommy Thompson have brought to my attention that there's a new editorial that has just appeared in PLOS in January 09 on waging peace through neglected tropical disease control, a U.S. foreign policy for the bottom billion, and I would urge you all to look for that. We initiated this speaker series here at CSIS and the Center for Global Health Policy. We initiated this back when we launched the center in September as a forum to try and bring a number of diverse voices that are in leadership positions in different dimensions of global health to come forward and share with us their perspectives, their insights as to the key issues emerging and the way forward. This is meant to reveal also the diversity of personalities that have become really deeply engaged in leading in this effort. And I would put Governor Thompson at the top of that list. He served in the Bush administration as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Prior to that, was the longest-serving governor of Wisconsin. I believe it was 16 years. In both of those periods, brought about major reforms in approaches on health in the state of Wisconsin and domestically within the United States. And he became, in his tenure as Secretary of HHS, a pivotal figure on the international side of things. And I think one of the most remarkable achievements really was having such a strong guiding hand in getting the Global Fund up and running and legitimizing and validating and getting the board of that fund to function in a pretty remarkably successful way. We just had here a short while ago one of Governor Thompson's acolytes, deputies, Bill Steiger, was here reflecting on his tenure as the senior advisor for international health affairs at HHS, and was talking about the Global Fund and about WHO. And one of the really impressive aspects of that talk was just how positive and forward-leaning the discussion was about the Global Fund and the outcome of the relationship that has been struck by that. I think this is a very important foundation as we look forward on the agenda for this administration on global health. We'll hear a lot this afternoon about neglected tropical diseases. I'm very, very grateful to Peter, to Governor Thompson, to Kari Stover, Daryl Edwards, and the other staff here and the other partners for really putting a spotlight on this and putting a lot of new energy. This is an area which we'll hear more about this afternoon where real gains are possible on a very affordable basis with the right combination of political will, a little bit of cash, and some smart implementation strategies. So with that, I'd like to please join me in welcoming Governor Thompson to speak.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Steve. Steve Morrison is an outstanding leader. I had the privilege of going to Vietnam with him, and we traveled from the north to the south and talking about HIV/AIDS and how we can contain it. And I can't thank you enough, Steve, for being involved with that project and what you've already done here at CSIS, and also, of course, the most important thing he got is education at the University of Wisconsin. So you got to know that he is an outstanding individual and somebody that I'm very proud to know, and thank you very much for putting on this lecture series. I want to talk to you today about a subject that is extremely passionate, something that I personally am passionate about, and something that I think is so important. I'm going to be a little bit broad at the beginning. I'm not going to get to neglected tropical diseases until towards the end of my speech, and then I'm going to introduce Dr. Peter Hotez, who is the number one worm doctor in the world, and my friend. But I got very much involved in global medical diplomacy, international health. And I want to tell you what I encountered and why I think it would be important for the United States of America to take a whole different tact in regards to foreign policy. I got involved because I, as Secretary of Health and Human Services, I wanted to see how we could extend and expand the authority, the power, the influence, and the support for the department worldwide. And so I traveled a lot, and several individuals who are in the room, Ann Peterson for one, my friends in the front aisle here who were very much involved with me in setting up the Global Fund or being involved in that. And a lot of people have a tremendous lot to say about it. But what I want to tell you today is what I experienced and why it changed my philosophy and changed my life and why I think it's so important for America to get involved in this. And that is global medical diplomacy. I went to Africa on a trip, and some of the individuals in this room were with me. And we went there, and we went to Botswana, a country where 38% of the people were infected with HIV. A country of about 3 million people, a little bit less. A beautiful country. But a country was destined to fail unless we got involved. We then went to South Africa, and Tony Fauci was with me. And we went to several, Dr. Fauci, who is really is the number one research scientist for AIDS in the world. And he was with me, and we went to this orphanage that had just been started about a year before we got there. It was started by the Jesuits, priests. And we went there, and we were there, and there was approximately 70 children between the ages of 6 weeks to 5 years. It was a new orphanage just to set up for children that were HIV positive. And I'll never forget this. I was there, and I held this little three-year-old girl, and she looked up at me with those beautiful eyes, and all she wanted to do was to have somebody hold her and love her and say things were going to be okay. Hank Kimmel from Pfizer was there, and I asked him to pick up a baby boy, and he picked him up, and Hank is a very rough businessman and very direct. And I could see him holding that baby boy, and I could see the tears come down his eyes. And he, after we left, he pulled out his personal checkbook and wrote out a check so that they could expand the orphanage. I tell you the story because when I left there, on the way back from from Africa, I turned to Tony Fauci, and I says, this is, something is really bad here. And he says, yes, there is a medicine called nomorphine. How do I pronounce this?
Nevirapine.
And nevirapine, and it will prevent the transmission of HIV from a mother to a child. And the country of South Africa, with the Minister of Health, was opposed to it. And I told Tony Fauci on the way home on that plane that we had to develop a plan. And we developed a plan, we took it to the president, and he not only accepted that plan, but he expanded. And he expanded it to the PEPFAR program. But it was started on that trip to Africa. And the president, President Bush's legacy is really going to be built around what took place on that trip, because the PEPFAR program was a direct result of that, and allowing the United States of America to invest in 16 countries worldwide to hold down and trying to prevent HIV. It was a wonderful thing. And right after that, we got involved with the United Nations, and Kofi Annan came down to see me and asked if I could be present when he met with the president, and also if I could support a new concept, a concept called a Global Fund for Fighting AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. We started out with just a concept, and President Bush was generous enough, and as president, he suggested that we put in the first $200 million. It was $200 million that really started the Global Fund. That Global Fund then went on, and we got several countries to contribute, and we started out with an idea and a few hundreds of millions of dollars, and I was lucky enough to be the chairman of the board for 3.5 years. And we went from an idea and a concept, ladies and gentlemen, to a fund that went from nothing to $5 billion in about 18 months. We had programs in over 127 countries, and we had over 200 programs. It was an absolutely huge success. It was for the first time the continent of Africa really felt that the United States and Europe were concerned about the plight facing people in Africa. There was a whole different concept, a belief that people really cared about what was taking place in Africa. And we grew that fund, and that fund has been extremely successful. I don't know of any corporation in the world that ever started out with an idea that grew to $5 billion in less than 2 years. And now it's over $8 billion. We're now in 135 countries, and we have over 300 programs helping to prevent AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And for the first time, people think we are going to be able to contain HIV. They think we have a chance maybe to really reduce and possibly even eradicate malaria and be able to control tuberculosis. Fantastic successes and great dreams. And then I went, after I was the chairman of the board, I took a group of 104 leaders from all over the world to go and visit Africa. I had individuals that were people in government from Europe, from America, senators and congressmen, religious. We had people from the United Nations, the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, all came on this trip. And there were so many huge egos in the plane when we took off from Germany that the plane didn't use any gas once we got up. It just levitated all the way to Africa. We got to Africa, and we went to several countries, and we went to Uganda finally. And in Uganda, I made every person on that plane spend a day in a village with somebody that lived with AIDS. And we had to go out. We left Kigali at 4:30 in the morning because it was a 3.5-hour trip on a bus. And we got out there, and we got to a little community called Tororo in the state of Busia. And at this clinic that was run by CDC actually administered to 650,000 people. And we had to get on little motorcycles, Yamahas. And I ride a Harley. That was the only downer in the trip. I didn't have a Harley. I had to get on one of these other kind of second-rate motorcycles. But we had to take the motorcycles out into the village in order to see the people. And I had my daughter, Tommy, with me. And she'll never be the same because of what that trip meant to her and how it influenced her life. We went to the first person that I was there with, and a woman by the name of Rosemary. And I went there, and I saw this woman, and she told me her story. And I expected to see this African lady that would be very decimated and very sickly because she was supposed to have died in 2001. And when I was there, I instead found this wonderful, beautiful, ebullient African lady. And she told me her story. And I'll never forget this. Her husband died in 1994 with AIDS, leaving her with three children to raise. And next year, in 1995, her brother died, who lived right next door, leaving her with four more children to raise, plus an elderly mother. And because her husband owned the land, but in that tribe, the land didn't go to her, Rosemary, it went to her husband's brother. And so she had to pay rent on these 2 hectares, which is about 5 acres. And she got $70 a year. And she was on her deathbed from AIDS in 2001 and was supposed to die. And they had already built a crypt to bury her in. And then we started delivering antiretroviral drugs. And when I was there, which was in 2004, I met this lady who was active, running the family with 7 children. And she lived in a mud hut with 2 rooms, one for the children and one she lived in. And she invited me in and was so happy. And I talked to her and she says, "Mr. Secretary, I want you to go back to America and say thank you to America, to the President, to Congress, and to the people, and to your department. Because what you did, you gave us the drugs and you allowed me to live. And by allowing me to live, I'm going to be able to raise these 7 children. And they will not become part of the 12 to 14 million orphanages that live in sub-Saharan Africa." And that was powerful. And I went back and I met the 104 people and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have got to start a movement in America on global medical diplomacy." And that global medical diplomacy is what I really want to talk about today and then get into neglected tropical diseases. Because it is so powerful. And I traveled to 37 countries. And in all the countries I went to, the women, the government leaders were always looking for what they could do to promote good health. And I went to Afghanistan 4 times. And as all of you know, the women in Afghanistan were treated just like chattel. Probably worse than the pets and the animals that the individuals kept. Women could not go to school. They could not practice medicine, could not do anything. And women, if they wanted to go and see a doctor, they had to go to a male doctor. They had to bring their own sutures and their own bandages because the hospitals didn't have it. And this one place in Kabul I went in, and I noticed that in this hospital, in all the hospitals, there was no running water. So that if a woman had to go in and get a cesarean, they'd have to bring a male doctor in and start doing the cesarean without scrubbing up. And all of you would know the infection and the death. 16% of the children die before in childbirth. 1/4 die before age 5. And it was the second worst country in the world for maternal death. And I came back and I talked to the president and Condi and Don Rumsfeld. And I said, "We have to do something about it. We have to build a hospital for women and children." And so I raised $2 million and we went back and remodeled the hospital just for women and children. And I went back there on Easter Sunday, 2003, to open it up. And in the auditorium were 700 women, none of which could understand my language. They were not invited, but they came for one reason, and that reason was to say thank you to America and thank you to me for being there, for building a hospital for women and children. And that was so powerful. And I looked out and I said, if you really want to win the world war on terror, it's to the hearts and minds of women in those societies. And the same thing happened in the tsunami. And since the tsunami, prior to the tsunami, Reuters did a poll in Indonesia. 75% of the people polled said that they disliked or hated America and Americans, and 25% were favorably disposed. And you know something? The tsunami came in America. But this generosity sent money, and we in the department sent a ship called Mercy a hospital ship with volunteer help, and the ports of Jakarta and so on. And they spent 6 weeks there with volunteers. And the day the ship left, there were thousands of people down on the port waving American flags, saying thank you. And the next month or so, they did another poll. The poll was just the opposite. 75% of the people polled were favorably disposed to America, and 25% were still opposed. A tremendous shift, a paradigm shift in that country. All because of global medical diplomacy, a word that I coined. And I decided that looking at these examples, we have these two giant ships, one Mercy and one the Comfort. One's in Baltimore and one's in San Diego. Modern ships that are giants. They're larger, they're as large as 3 football fields. And they have enough beds in there with modern equipment. You can do brain surgery, you can even do transplants. And we got them here, and I thought to myself, what a tremendous opportunity for America if we would allow these ships to sail around the world with young medical school students that are just fresh out of medical school, be able to go into these ports and be able to administer the needs of individuals. Can you imagine a giant ship floating into a poor country, the port, and getting out with young idealistic men and women fresh out of medical school to teach and to administer and to take care of people? It would be the biggest public relations coup that America could ever have. And that is the kind of foreign policy that I envision, that I believe medical diplomacy is where we can really make a giant step forward and not have to go to war. Medical diplomacy is so much more powerful and so much more lasting than bullets in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Africa. And that's what medical diplomacy is all about. And now getting to neglected tropical diseases. When I left the government, I still wanted to be involved because it's a passion of mine, as you can tell, to do something. And Dr. Hotez and Carrie Stover came to me and says, we have another situation that is probably broader and probably affects more people and actually can be controlled easier than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And it's called neglected tropical diseases. There are 14 of them. And there are 7 main that really afflict 90% of the people. And when you consider there are worldwide, there are 6 billion people that live there. And 1 billion of those individuals have a neglected tropical disease. And that you can administer to those individuals for only 52 cents a year. When I tell that, people come up and say, I'll take 3. I'll take 5, I'll take 10. But for 52 cents, you can cure these diseases. And I was in Rwanda in August with Jason Denby, was in Tanzania in November and December, and I saw what we could do. 1 billion people afflicted by neglected tropical diseases. Ascariasis, trichoriasis, hookworm, schistosomiasis, onchocerciasis, trachoma, and lymphatic filariasis. And all of these affect the poorest people in the world, people that make less than $2 a day, and individuals that either their minds have been somehow stymied, their growth has, and we can change that and allow these people to have a better quality of life and be able to have an opportunity to make a decent living. Because these diseases are disfiguring, they're disabling, and they put on individuals that are afflicted with them a sort of a an attitude they can't be any better. And they're sort of looked at in their villages as people that are unclean, like leprosy. And they're all based from worms. When we were in Rwanda, we met with the president, President Kagame, who was doing a wonderful job, and he organized the military, the schools, the university, the villages, the education department, the health department, and he went out to vaccinate, deworm, and give family planning to 5 million, one half of the citizens, in 8 days, and we accomplished that. And in 8 days, we vaccinated and dewormed over 5 million children and mothers. And everybody was compelled to come to a central place in the village, either a clinic or the school, and we were there. And I'll never forget it. We went around, and the children were so happy to know that somebody really cared. And I'll never forget this young man who came up, and he was about the size of my 5-year-old granddaughter. And he was 16 years of age, and he had an extended belly. And you could run your hand over that belly, and you could feel the worms going up and down the wall of the stomach. And by giving him 2 pills twice a year, that is taken care of. But that child is going to be stunted for the rest of his life, but he still has 2 more years to regain some of that growth, but he has not been able to learn in skill in school. And just, boy, the amount of medicine that's given to us by the pharmaceutical companies, the opportunity to deworm and vaccinate these children, we can really change the quality of life and the quality of health of villages all over. And that's what the fight for neglected tropical diseases is all about. And what we're here today is to enroll and enlist and hope that you will travel with us to Africa or the Caribbean. We're pretty much taking care of neglected tropical diseases in America, even though there are outbreaks every once in a while in some poor areas. But it does so much good. So much good for the world, so much good for those villagers and individuals. And it does you so much good. And that's what America is all about. And you can do this through medical diplomacy, whether it be AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, neglected tropical diseases. And that's why I'm so happy the CSIS is putting on this program so we get a chance to get this information out. And for 50 cents contribution, you can buy enough medicine to treat one person for a year. Isn't that amazing? And there are 1 billion of those individuals in the world that need that help. And so I think it's a cause that's worth fighting for. And the beauty is we actually can eliminate all of the 14. None of the 14 need to be there. They're all worm-based. And that is why I wanted to bring my partner, my friend, and the number one worm doctor in the world, Peter Hotez, to come and talk scientifically and medically about neglected tropical diseases. Peter Hotez runs the Sabin Institute, which, of course, most of you know was started by Dr. Sabin for polio. He also is a distinguished professor of medicine in worms at the University of George Washington. He's going to receive a high honor very shortly. And I'm going to have the privilege to introduce him, I hope. But he's one of those individuals that has absolutely dedicated his life to really bringing change and making this world a better place. So with that, I introduce my friend who used to be 6'6" when he started in this quest and now is the size that you see because he's worked so hard and has carried so much weight. He has shrunk down to the size he is right now. I give you my friend, Dr. Peter Hotez.
It's given new meaning to the term heavy lifting, hasn't it? When I agreed to appear with Secretary Thompson, I thought we had the understanding that I wouldn't have to follow him. So he's the hardest act in the world to follow. So I hope – so we kind of reverse things. We put the Rolling Stones ahead of the warm-up act, but I hope you'll bear with me. I'll try to be brief and just go through a few slides, a few PowerPoint slides to give you kind of an overview of why these diseases are so absolutely important. Before I begin, I just want to thank my good colleagues at the Sabin Vaccine Institute, Aaron Hallfelder, Karen Palacio, Suzanne Levy, Chloe Cooney from the Endeavor Group, Lydia DeGrazia from George Washington, and of course Jason Denby for their help in putting this together. And Dr. Morrison, thank you so much for giving us this very distinguished venue to talk about these conditions. If I could get the lights down a little bit in the front, that would be a big help because the slides are kind of dark and they're not easy to see. So when we talk about these neglected tropical diseases, we're really referring to the most common conditions of, for want of a better term, the bottom billion, a term that was partially coined by Paul Collier, the Oxford University economist, to refer to the poorest people in the world who live on no money, live on less than a dollar a day. The World Bank has changed that a little bit. Now they say there's 1.4 billion people who live on less than $1.25 a day as the new criteria for the poorest people. It's not quite as poetic as the bottom billion, but you get the same sense. So these are, it turns out, the most common infections of the bottom billion, and most people have never heard of these diseases, even though the evidence points to the fact that these diseases in aggregate are as important as AIDS or malaria or TB, better-known conditions, and yet few people have heard of them. So the most common infections of the bottom billion, all of them are infected. Let me just give you the quick laundry list of the seven most common. They include the one that Secretary Thompson referred to, ascariasis, the large common roundworm. So those of you who worked in developing countries will recognize this child or a child like it. It was a picture taken by one of my students working in Haiti where the child is stunted for height and weight. He's got a big belly. And indeed, you could run your hand over the surface of his abdomen and palpate the outline of these intestinal worms. 807 million people, mostly kids, essentially all of the kids of the bottom billion have these worms in their intestine. Same with trichuriasis, which is one of the problems is the pronunciation. You did a great job, Secretary. Is the whipworm, which are in the colon, hookworms in the small intestine, which cause blood loss, 600 million, extraordinary numbers. Schistosomiasis, which are flukes that live in the blood vessels and cause blood to appear in the urine and the stool, 207 million, 120 million with lymphatic filarial worms in the genitals and lymphatics, 84 million people with trachoma, which is the only non worm neglected tropical disease, or NTD, on our list, which is a huge cause of blindness, and same with river blindness or onchocerciasis, also a huge cause of blindness. So the first point is there are a lot of people with these parasitic worm infection, neglected tropical diseases. The other is that now, through a series of studies that have been conducted all over the world, when we look at them in terms of disability, not so much in terms of death, but in terms of ability to ruin lives using a metric, which is sometimes known as the DALY, the Disability Adjusted Life Year, the number of healthy life years lost either from premature death or disability. These neglected tropical diseases in aggregate are as important as HIV/AIDS or malaria or TB, the better known condition. But they also do something which is very interesting. They have the ability to not only occur in the setting of poverty, but they actually promote poverty. And they promote poverty because, first of all, most of these neglected tropical diseases, most of which are worm infections, actually impair physical growth. The more worms you have, the more stunted you are. They not only impair growth, but they ruin IQ. The more worms you have, the greater your loss in IQ is. The more worms you have, the greater your loss in memory and cognition. So as a result, the more worms you have, the worse you do on your tests of educational performance and school attendance. And now Hoyt Bleakley, who's an international development economist at the University of Chicago, has done a study to indicate that chronic hookworm infection in childhood reduces your future wage earning capacity by 43%. So these are the stealth reason why the bottom billion can't escape poverty. It's because they're too sick because of these chronic worm infections. So this huge impact on intellectual and physical development in children. An important impact on pregnancy outcome. These are not just pediatric diseases. I'll show you a slide in a minute. Essentially, one-third of pregnant women in sub-Saharan Africa have hookworm. Why do women get sick in childbirth? Primarily because of bleeding and blood loss and anemia. These are major underlying causes of anemia and result in poor pregnancy outcome, meaning higher maternal morbidity and mortality, but also low birth weight. So these are why kids are being born premature and stunted when they're from the day they're born is because of hookworm and schistosomiasis. A very huge impact on worker productivity. Remember, these are the diseases of the subsistence farmers and their family, people who are just raising enough crops to support their family. Chronic lymphatic filariasis, one of the very important NTDs, neglected tropical diseases, causes $1.5 billion in economic losses in India alone every year, 88% reduction in agricultural productivity in Ghana. So these are actually keeping people mired in poverty. They not only occur in the setting of poverty, but they're promoting poverty as well. This is just one example that I could use to, we could spend a whole day talking about why these neglected tropical diseases destroy lives. This is just an example of the impact on maternal health. It was picked up by Don McNeil in the New York Times recently, who we reported that one-third of pregnant women have hookworm. Incredible numbers if you think about it. 7 million pregnant women with hookworm infection, 44 million pregnant women with hookworm worldwide. Now, we're here today to not only talk about poverty, but because we're at CSIS, we also want to talk about the implications of these diseases in terms of global diplomacy. And so Secretary Thompson and I have written a paper, which is now just got published today. It's on the Public Library of Science website, so it's an open access journal. You can go to plos.org and just and find that paper. And what we've done is to identify not only the impact of these neglected tropical diseases on destroying health and destroying poverty, but a very interesting observation showing how these neglected tropical diseases actually seem to promote conflict. So I'm going to come back to the slide in a minute, but I just wanted to show you what we found was this curious overlap for a number of neglected tropical diseases. They occurred in the hot spots of the world where you have conflict. What we found is a very interesting relationship between the two, which I'll talk to you about now. So first of all, you can overlay maps of the two. That's one. On the bottom right is one of these important neglected tropical diseases where we've looked in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, Central African Republic, and Sudan, and where in the 1930s we had very high rates of infection. Through aggressive tsetse fly control in the case of sleeping sickness, we brought levels down to close to zero. But then because of all of the conflicts that were occurring in those four countries that I just mentioned, we were for a while back up to 1930s levels. So a very intimate relationship between conflict and neglected tropical diseases. Now the point of this paper is that things go both ways, that not only do neglected tropical diseases emerge in the setting of conflict, but it may work the other way around, that they actually promote conflict, one, because they're so incredibly destabilizing. So first of all, they have an important role, a pivotal role in the world's food crisis. And the reason for that is essentially when you're feeding kids, you're feeding the worms, because these worms compete for the host for nutrients. And as a result, a lot of the effort that's going into for agricultural development is actually like pouring money down the drain because it's being taken up by the worms. A huge impact on reducing education and future wage earning, which is another way they promote instability, they promote ignorance, and very importantly is community destabilization. So as rates of lymphatic filariasis go above a certain point in an endemic village in Africa or India, or as the rate of onchocerciasis, river blindness, goes beyond a certain rate, what we find is that rates of agricultural productivity decline dramatically, and at the same time what happens is farmers abandon their fields. They're forced to because the rates of the infections are so high and so endemic. So as a result, they'll abandon their fields to go to less fertile ground. And so there's this horrible synergy between reducing agricultural productivity and abandoning the fields. So these are just to impress upon you some numbers. These are all sort of country hotspots that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be concerned about in the coming administration: Angola, Central African Republic, DRC, Somalia, Iran, Burma, Cambodia, North Korea, Colombia, Haiti. One of the things they share is that they have the highest rates of neglected tropical diseases anywhere else in the world. In some cases, 70, 80, 90, in a few cases, 100% of the poorest people living in these areas are chronically infected. And that's an important point about these diseases. These are not acute infections like you get with a common cold, where you have them for a couple of weeks and then they resolve. When people have these neglected tropical diseases, unless they're treated, they harbor these infections for years, frequently decades, frequently the entire life of the individual. These parasites have managed to learn to live a long time in the intestines and in the blood vessels of these individuals. So we're looking at a situation where people are affected for years and it has these long-term effects. So what we have found is how lands are abandoned in sub-Saharan Africa, how lymphatic filariasis festers among ethnic minorities in Burma, leishmaniasis in guerrilla areas of Colombia, guinea worm in the Sudan, and then the ubiquitous hookworms, schistosomiasis, river blindness in Sudan, Central African Republic, DRC, and Angola. That's the bad news. The good news is that at our global network for neglected tropical diseases, and we're very proud of our little worm in the globe over there in the upper right-hand corner, we have, with our partners, which include most of the major public-private partnerships working in the developing world, I developed a package of drugs that can simultaneously target all of the seven most common neglected tropical diseases. And quite interestingly, the drug companies are donating these drugs, with the exception of a couple, which are available as low-cost generics. So that's an example where the drug companies are actually the good guys. So Merck is donating ivermectin. GlaxoSmithKline is donating albendazole. Pfizer is donating azithromycin. And we can put these four drugs together in a package to simultaneously target the seven most common neglected tropical diseases. And as Secretary Thompson said, we can do this for 50 cents a person per year. So imagine taking on the most common infections of the bottom billion, which in aggregate produce disability as high as AIDS, as high as malaria. But instead of doing this for hundreds of dollars a year for antiretrovirals, or $50 a year for direct observed therapy for TB, or even $10, $20 a year for antimalarials and bed nets, we can do it for 50 cents a person per year. What's more is that by distributing these drugs, several of our partners, like the African Program for Onchocerciasis Control, has mobilized an army of 470,000 community drug distributors, volunteer community drug distributors that are delivering the package. What's really neat now is we hand them a bed net to go along with it, and the use of antimalarial bed nets goes up ninefold, which was published a couple of years ago. So that now we can piggyback all sorts of interventions onto this neglected tropical disease rapid impact package, not only the neglected tropical disease drugs, but childhood vaccinations, vitamin A, antimalarials, and bed nets. It's really a great story. So we've got treatment programs now going on in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America. We are going to announce in a few days a major initiative that I can't say too much about that's going to be supported by some of our investors. But the point is that even without large-scale investments, even with small-scale investments, we can go a long way. A school child, someone in high school, can donate 50 cents and make a huge impact on the life of an individual. Finally, I'll end here The other part of the business of the Sabin Vaccine Institute is we not only deliver drugs, but we also develop new generation products for neglected diseases. One of the problems that we're having with hookworm, a very important one, is that we think we may be seeing the beginning of drug resistance, so we think we have to develop a vaccine. So one of the things that we've done now is to create an organization that with laboratories at George Washington University that's actually developing a new first-generation recombinant hookworm vaccine, which, if you think about it, scientific hurdles aside, which I won't go into today, you can imagine the economic challenges of this, trying to make a product for that's guaranteed to fail financially because, by definition, you only get hookworm if you're a member of the bottom billion. So this is almost like a guaranteed money-losing company based here in Washington. We can't call it that, of course, so we call it a product development partnership, but it's basically a guaranteed money-losing company. And the reason I bring that up in this context is that there's an additional opportunity for medical diplomacy that goes beyond delivering treatments, and that is joint medical research opportunities. Very few people are aware of it, but that the oral polio vaccine that many of us received as children was actually developed jointly by the Americans and the Soviets at the height of the Cold War. So what happened was, in 1956, shortly after Sputnik, the Soviet Union was having massive polio outbreaks. Through back-channel diplomacy, Soviet virologists came to Albert Sabin's laboratories, which were then at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Sabin got permission from the State Department to go back to Russia with those polio strains and jointly developed the oral polio vaccine, which was tested on 60 million Soviet schoolchildren before it was brought back to the U.S. for licensure and then widely deployed throughout the United States. So it was a great example of how two diametrically opposed countries, you can imagine what it was like in 1956, on both sides would put aside their ideologies for purposes of joint vaccine development. And so we're also very interested in looking at the possibilities of how we can apply that model today to some of our countries that we may not have the very best diplomatic relationships with. So I'll stop here just to ask you to join our fight for the global network. It's go to globalnetwork.org and learn more about the countries in which where we work. We've created a loose change initiative, again, 50 cents a person per year, and we're hoping to really make this a very important global health priority issue in the next few years. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you, Secretary Thompson, for your enormous support.
Dr. Peter and myself will take questions from anybody in the audience on global medical diplomacy, neglected tropical diseases, global fund, or anything else you would like to talk about. And I just would like to, one conclusion that I would like to point out, one point is that for $500 million, $500 million, we could absolutely strike a blow for freedom on neglected tropical diseases. And that is how big the problem is, but how we can actually achieve a victory in this field. Questions? Go ahead.
Sam Rosman with the Congressional Subcommittee on Africa and Global Health. My question is to Dr. Hotez. You were mentioning briefly drug resistance, and I was wondering if you had concerns about a program that would implement a widespread, lots of drugs into an area, and then if that area descended into civil conflict, those drugs would be unavailable. Is that sort of ebb and flow of drugs, would that worry you in terms of building resistance to them?
So the answer to your question is yes, it worries me, but not as much as some other diseases. One of the reasons is these worm infections are very slowly replicating, so that the likelihood of resistance is inversely proportional to the replication time. So this is not like a virus like HIV or even a malaria parasite, which is rapidly replicating. So the time frame for resistance to develop is extremely slow. So we've been, the only one drug after some 15, 20 years, and fragmented ways of being used and with lots of interruptions. Is some evidence now drug failure for mebendazole? So we're concerned about it. We think, you know, an important part of the message is to continue to innovate, continue to develop new products, but certainly not withhold these drugs for this theoretical risk. To deny access to these essential medicines obviously would be a huge moral and ethical failing.
Dr. Hotez, I'm Dave Tarantino with the U.S. Navy and currently on a fellowship here. I'm wondering if you see any of the NTDs as good candidates for eradication, either in a given locale or a region or even globally.
So that's an excellent point. So the question is, of these seven, do we stand a chance to actually eliminate? We don't tend not to use the word eradicate as much, but eliminate as a public health problem. Certainly the two that look very promising are lymphatic filariasis and trachoma. So, for instance, now in many middle-income and some low-income countries, when we've gone through 2 to 6 rounds of the drug used for lymphatic filariasis, which is either ivermectin donated by Merck or diethyl carbamazine, which is available for 0.4 cents a tablet, 4 to 6 rounds, meaning once a year, every year for 2 to 6 years, we've now eliminated those diseases in at least 12 countries. So, and now it looks Egypt like it might be close as well. So that's very exciting, which is something that you're never going to do with HIV/AIDS, you're never going to do with malaria, you're never going to do with TB, actually eliminate these diseases. Morocco just became the first country to eliminate trachoma, and we expect others to follow as well. So for at least those two, we have a great prospect of eliminating, with the others making a big impact in terms of control.
Secretary.
Yes.
These various drugs, you don't really need the health infrastructure that you might need for HIV and malaria or the health professionals and that community-trained professionals can administer. Am I getting that right? And is there a question of kind of the storage and the supply of the drugs in terms of, you know, shelf life and that kind of issue?
Yeah, the drugs are very stable. They're also very safe in addition to being very inexpensive. And you're right. We're not talking about an antiretroviral that you have to administer every day. We're talking about once a year. But having said that, now that we've got these, there is some degree of training required, not a lot. But now that we've got this army of community drug distributors, we're starting to think, you know, maybe this is really capacity building. Now we can fold in other interventions, and I think there's going to be a lot of parallels, particularly with malaria and the opportunity to add antimalarial bed nets, artemisinin and combination therapy too, with these community drug distributors in place. So it is capacity building, absolutely. It varies, days. You know, a couple of sessions, it's fairly simple, partly because the safety profile is so high for these drugs.
Christy Lubinsky, Infectious Diseases Society of America. A question for Governor Thompson, actually related to the Global Fund. As I'm sure you're well aware, the latest round of funding for the Global Fund has had to be delayed for lack of resources. And notwithstanding the tremendous progress made through PEPFAR and the Global Fund, there is a tremendous amount of work still to be done on HIV, TB, and malaria. And many of us are worried about the obvious. We're in the middle of a worldwide economic crisis. A tremendous amount of time and energy and money are going into trying to get us out of that domestically. And at the same time, we have tremendous commitments overseas in developing countries, and many of us would like to expand our work on HIV, TB, malaria, as well as the important neglected tropical diseases. So I guess I'd like your thoughts on whether you think the U.S. Commitment to these diseases, as well as the neglected diseases under discussion today, is sustainable, can be expanded, and how, you know, what are your thoughts about how we can make those arguments both to the new administration as well as to a very worried Congress interested in bailing their own states and communities out?
I certainly hope so. The truth of the matter is that it is such a tremendous investment. and foreign policy to fight these diseases. I had the privilege of being on the board of the World Health Organization, and the African countries, the ministers of health, were so pessimistic about their future and their country and their whole continent prior to PEPFAR, prior to the Global Fund. And the Global Fund and PEPFAR changed their attitudes and changed, you know, the dynamics in the whole continent of Africa, that people were concerned, and it was so important. And just like my examples in Afghanistan, I mean, if you really want to win the war in Afghanistan, it's through changing the minds and hearts of the people there. And medical diplomacy is a lot cheaper than building bombs and tanks and so on and so forth. So granted, we have to have a strong military, but if you really want something permanent, the fight for the hearts and minds of people in various countries that don't particularly care for us, I think it's through healthcare, and I think it's through medical diplomacy. And it's such a wonderful investment, and it's so long-lasting. So nobody knows what's going to happen with this recession and downturn. It's serious, and we all know that, and it's global. And anytime you go into a recession like this, countries, you know, hunker down, and they don't give the contributions necessary. But I could make a very valid argument, and will to anybody that will listen, that this is not the place to cut. This is the place to expand. And it's cheaper, and it's a long-term investment in the future of our country and the world. And that, to me, it's worth the expenditures 7 days a week.
I think the analogy we gave is, for the cost of two F-18 fighters, we could take on the neglected tropical diseases in all the conflict countries of Africa. So the add-on cost is trivial, and the impact is, you know, think of it, for an extra 5%, an extra 2%, you can double your impact.
For $500 million, we could have a fantastic victory in the field of neglected tropical diseases. And Peter is right. I use the example, there was a development called the Apache. It was a airplane that was being developed, and the United States of America was committed $32 billion for it, and after an expenditure of $8 billion, they scrapped it. And I thought to myself, my Lord, for $8 billion, give me half of that, and I could win the hearts and minds of a whole continent in Africa with Indonesia or whatever. And that, to me, is... you know, I think we get our priorities a little bit mixed up.
My question is for Secretary Thompson. Some of the countries, especially in Africa, affected by neglected tropical disease, have been friends of the U.S. since the 60s. And some of those countries have U.S. Embassy, have USAID program. What are you suggesting now? What would it be different from having U.S. Embassy, USAID development program in those countries?
Oh, I think that's happening. We, Jason and I, just came back from Tanzania, and the ambassador there, Mark Green, was fully involved in the fight on AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and neglected tropical diseases. And he went out with us, out to the villages. The Minister of Health of Tanzania was with us, and I was there on a Sunday. And people from CDC and from USAID and from other federal departments all came out on a Sunday. I mean, to see me. I can understand when I was secretary, but I'm nothing now. I'm just Tommy Thompson. And they came out to see me to tell me what they were doing, and they were absolutely committed to organizing village by village and getting the medicines out to people, whether it be antiretroviral drugs or the drugs to defeat neglected tropical diseases. And what I really found is the attitudes of the ministers of health of the African countries. They have changed completely, and they are looking for ways that they can work closer in cooperation with American departments and American agents to really do this. It is it's wonderful to see, because I've been involved in this now for 8 years, and I can remember back 8 years ago when you wouldn't find that cooperation. And I can remember when USAID wouldn't have anything to do with the Department of Health and Human Services. And I can remember when they were all fighting over the turf battles. And I can remember when the Global Fund was resented by some people in the federal government and so on. And that's all seems to have dissipated. And there's a, you know, I'm sure there's still some of it there, but the degree of harmony in country, along with in-country in the United States, with the people and the embassies there and with the federal departments in that various country, or in the various countries, has just been heartwarming for me to see, and see the tremendous progress is being made. Great progress. Doesn't mean that we don't have a long ways to go, but there's been great progress in the last 8 years. Sir?
Mr. Secretary, what is the status about intellectual property rights and the issue of development? Because about 10 years ago, I was in Korea when the Institute of Vaccine was established internationally, and we just opposed it. And basically, that development was focused on the needs of tropical countries, and the pharmaceutical industry was not willing to focus on their needs. Before that, I was in India, basically as a science officer with the State Department in both places. This was always a big problem.
It's always. It always has been, and it continues to this day, but much less so. The pharmaceutical industry made some terrible mistakes about 6 years ago when they brought a lawsuit in several countries in Africa, and that was, you know, that was probably one of their dumbest moves ever, because it turned the whole world against Big Pharma in America. But since that time, Big Pharma has, in the case of neglected tropical diseases, you know, everything we ask for pretty much is given to us. You know, you can't administer these drugs for 50 cents a person for a year without the generosity and the charitable giving of pharmaceutical companies, because the drugs cost more, but they're giving them to us at cost, or giving it to us, you know, as a contribution. So the intellectual property rights, you've got to have intellectual property rights for scientists, biotechs, and pharmaceutical companies to develop new drugs. And everybody knows that these drugs have a life cycle in which the viruses and the bacteria grow stronger, and you have to come up with new medicines. And you have to find medicines, you know, for new diseases. So you have to have intellectual property rights. But I find that there's a much more harmonious feeling in the world towards pharmaceutical companies, much more giving and contribution, and much more sharing. Not enough of the sharing, but it's getting much better. And I'm very happy about that, and I think it goes a long ways towards getting the drugs to people that need it in Africa and other in some other countries.
You know, I should just to reinforce what he just said, in that the issues regarding intellectual property for the neglected tropical diseases, I won't say are zero, but they tend to be much less acute than other global health problems. In the sense, they're not dual use, in the sense that these are not diseases that occur at all in the U.S. or Europe and Japan. So there's not even much of a military market or a traveler's market, because you only get these diseases when you're living for a long time in these developing countries. So, you know, we're funded for our hookworm vaccine by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They ask us to put forward a global access roadmap, which includes a detailed discussion of intellectual property, primarily, and they put that into place for things like AIDS and malaria, where there are both U.S., and developing country markets. It's really not so much of an issue. We like to say, if some guy in India wants to copy what we've done and vaccinate all of India, well, then God bless him. You know, we file patents. We're often not sure why we do it.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I just wanted to offer a couple quick observations and a question. One observation is that it seems that when you talk about river blindness and guinea worm, You've got two fairly dramatic success stories of the last period with fairly complex partnerships involving Carter Center pharmaceutical companies and different agencies and the like. And yet, it doesn't seem to, those success stories don't seem to translate in the popular mind too much as powerful examples that prove the concept. And why is that? So that's the first point. Is there more to be gained by looking at those stories? Second is, you didn't really talk much about China and India. When you put the figures up, it wasn't emerging. Large emerging countries that were the focus. The focus was really the most broken of places. The numbers that you put up for DRC or for Angola or for Cambodia, those are the places where you've got really deep concentrated problems and the obstacles are really formidable. And so maybe that's part of the problem, is trying to convince folks that neglected tropical diseases should be a priority within a broader global health strategy, which gets to my last point, where if you were to, Peter and Governor Thompson, if you were to identify the small subset of states in Africa or outside of Africa where you think the biggest gains could be made by a concentrated investment in the next 5 to 10 years in order to prove the point that you can have big gains on 6 or 7 of these, what would those be?
Mm-hmm.
What would those countries be? Because I doubt that you'd get much traction by saying DRC and Angola. You can't ignore those countries. There has to be an investment. But you're going to get a much bigger payback here in Washington and a constituency around this by picking 3 or 4 that are more like Rwandas or Tanzanias or Ghanas, where you're going to be able to make dramatic gains. And what would the strategy look like in your mind? Thank you.
Well, you asked about three questions, and the answers could be quite long-winded, but I'll try to just summarize a few points. First of all, with regard to guinea worm, you're right, it's a great success story, and the Carter Centers and their partners, including WHO, have taken this on. It's worth pointing out that at its worst, guinea worm had 3.2 million infections worldwide. So what we're talking about now is something much more ambitious, hundreds of millions, a billion people. So I think the Carter Center provided important proof of concept that with the political will of the president and WHO that you can make a big impact on a disease. Now we're going to go after the big one, the one that's hundreds of millions. With regard to the distribution in middle and low-income countries, you're right. These are diseases in India and China and Brazil, but I should mention they're only in the very poorest segments of those countries. So they're very unevenly distributed. So you don't go into Beijing or Shanghai and see these diseases quickly. You have to go into Yunnan province and Guangxi and in parts of Sichuan province, Hainan province, the real poor rural areas. For you to see them. Regarding where do you begin, I think you're right. The conflict and post-conflict countries are the most daunting. It wouldn't be our if we wanted to go out, start with a home run, you wouldn't necessarily pick DRC, which is half the size of the United States, and it's very difficult to work there. So that the Global Network has identified a list of priority countries, but we don't shy away from conflict or post-conflict countries necessarily, because even there, the community drug distributors have been working there and have had some great success stories in places like Sudan and Angola as well. So we have a priority list, but we haven't totally written off the conflict and post-conflict countries yet.
I would I would only add to what Peter said about the countries that we can have the biggest impact on. You got to realize that certain groups in the Congress and around Washington, D.C., that are really individuals that can influence power are individuals and groups that have certain attachments to certain countries. Rwanda is a big one because of the genocide. And Rwanda is one that you can have huge success in just because the government is stable and there's a great deal of sort of remorse in America that we didn't do more in the genocidal period. And so that's one immediately that jumps out. South Africa, you know, we haven't dwelled much on South Africa, but South Africa's Minister of Health, you know, really didn't do as much as they should have in fighting AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And now that administration has changed. The Minister of Health has changed, much more active and much more involved. Which, and South Africa is always one that has great support in America. And that one has got tremendous opportunities to improve, especially in AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Zimbabwe, you know, as soon as if ever Mugabe ever leaves, which he can't go on forever. He's 84 years old, and he has destroyed that country. And that, as soon as they have a change of leadership, you're going to be, I think, somewhat shocked by the amount of capital that wants to go in and help out Zimbabwe. Botswana is a country that is fairly wealthy. It's got a lot of natural resources, and it's a small population. It's a huge country, and very diversified, but it's got great, great opportunities to improve the health care because they have a government that wants to influence and change. Tanzania is another one. You know, Mark Green, we were there, and it was just an amazing thing to me. Uganda. Uganda is a one that I would think is just ready to be helped even more so. So those are the countries that I would think of. But I wouldn't give up on the Congo because the Congo, who's the basketball player?
Dikembe Mutombo.
Mutombo is building a hospital there and is really developing a great deal of a following. He wants me to go with him this summer, and I hope I can.
Christopher Williams, Georgetown University. You talk about treatment of individuals who are already infected, but what kind of preventative measures are you taking that are non-chemotherapeutic to prevent infection?
So that's a great question. Well, first of all, I should mention that the medicines, even though they're treatments, we sometimes call them preventive chemotherapy because, for instance, the drug for lymphatic filariasis doesn't directly treat the individual. It lowers the number of circulating microfilaria required for transmission, so they actually interrupt transmission in that particular instance. For trachoma, we also recommend what's known as the SAFE strategy, which includes simple surgery in addition to the antibiotics and environmental control. Clean water and sanitation are the mom and apple pie of global health. They can be extremely expensive interventions. What we have found is that when you use sanitation alone, in the absence of economic development, it has a very minor, trivial impact on reducing the prevalence of these diseases. And whenever possible, we encourage clean water and sanitation, and the World Health Assembly resolutions all support that as well. But it can be very expensive and very costly. But it's a great question.
This I wanted to introduce a young naval doctor who is with us. Andy Baldwin is in the audience. How are you, Andy? Thank you. You're going to be fine.
I'd just like to say thanks to Secretary. I went out on Mercy. I'm going out of comfort this summer. And, the power of medical diplomacy is huge. I wish people would go out and see it more. And the fact that the CNO and the Commandant have made medical diplomacy
You got a question? Go ahead.
Now I'm really on the hook. I'm Judith Kaufman. I'm an independent consultant. I was privileged to work with Secretary Thompson on things like the Global Fund. And I want to ask you something on global medical diplomacy. As you know, I come from the State Department, so the other side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And your thoughts on how diplomacy itself, the State Department, the more traditional tools of foreign policy, can be engaged in promoting global health?
First off, not only did you assist me, you led the way. You and your husband were absolutely the World Bank, and with the setting up the Global Fund, her husband was was my candidate to run the Global Fund. We didn't win, but he was an ambassador and just a fantastic American. I think the State Department has got to be much more aggressive. You look at the maps, and you see the need out there, and with Secretary Clinton now, with her notoriety, she could just be a world leader, a role model for trying to transform the State Department into leading with medical diplomacy. And I think President Obama wants to get away from the militaristic type of things that are taking place in Afghanistan and Iraq. And what better place than to try something new? It's like the Marshall Plan all over again. And you could rebuild the Marshall Plan, only use medical diplomacy. The ships, the Global Fund, the President's PEPFAR program. And President Bush's legacy is really the strongest part of his legacy is going to be what he did in medical diplomacy. And I'm very happy that I played a small role. I'm very happy, Mr. Kaufman, that you were there helping to lead the way. And the State Department could make the Obama administration, the foremost leaders in global medical diplomacy if they want to lead. And to me, there's just no downturn in the opportunities for that. It's just an upward opportunity for this administration, as it was for the Bush administration. It was interesting. I just got to give you a little factoid. Of the seven countries in the last 8 years that like America the best, all come from Africa. All come from Africa. You know why? It's the President's PEPFAR program. It's the Global Fund. It's medical diplomacy. Now, if you would ask that on a quiz, I bet 90% of the people that you would ask that would say that's not true. But if you look at the statistics and the polling, 7 of the 10 countries that value America the most is Africa. And that's strictly because of global medical diplomacy. And if you really want to win the war on terrorism, I'll say it once again, it's through the hearts and minds of women and children in these countries. Because no matter, of the 37 countries I visited in 4 years while I was secretary, there was one common denominator, and that common denominator was good health for themselves and their families. And that, permeates throughout the whole society. And that's why global medical diplomacy works, can work, will work, and should work, and is the way that I think the State Department should change in order to try and attract more information, more resources, and more development in that area.
The good news is the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Diseases was launched at the Clinton Global Initiative in 2006. And next to Secretary Thompson, the only two political leaders who know almost as much as about neglected tropical diseases is President Clinton and Secretary Clinton. So hopefully that will make a big impact.
Thank you very much. Please join me. I'll await the announcement that you alluded to. There's a video that is ready for us to share at this point. Daniel? Short video.
3 minutes. Government
under the great leadership of Paul Kagame, is setting forth for the people a standard of good health. And all of you are part of the new Rwanda that is making Rwanda a centerpiece for the continent of Africa.
Yeah, today is the kickoff of Maternal Child Health Week in Rwanda, and it's significant for two reasons. One, this is the first time since before the genocide that school-aged children will be receiving deworming medication alongside immunizations and some vitamins and other interventions. Since we are targeting 3.5 million school-aged children this week, 1.5 million preschool children, and about 50,000 pregnant women. The community is prepared beforehand. They know what they're receiving, and they come in high expectation and anticipation of the benefits they'll receive. You can treat these the seven most common neglected tropical diseases for as little as 50 cents per person per year.
There are three posts of treatment. There's 976 children in this school, but they are treating other children who are not in this school as well. Maybe we would start by visiting this.
Okay,
post.
Fine. Absolutely. No, mother.
New sour Claudette.
What's her name?
Claudette.
Hi, Claudette.
I'm very impressed by the government leaders of Rwanda. They really are trying to do what is best.
Put your thumbs up. It's a thumbs up. There, right there. There.
So many boys and girls with extended bellies that were all full of worms, and some kids who were 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, that their growth had been completely stunted. Is that 10?
He's 10. He's 13.
He's 13.
He's 13. She's 16. She came for the pills, for the treatment.
Yeah. They're all stunted then.
Yeah.
Rwanda can really be a testing ground for programs like the reduction of neglected tropical disease. It can actually be done in just a couple of years if there's good management, good coordination, serious commitment, and real transparency in the government. And this is going to be an example that gets talked about in the history books about what can be achieved in short order.
Today is a day of rejuvenation, a day of opportunity for these young people to get the medicines necessary so that they can get rid of the worms, prevent the parasitic diseases that accompany those worms, and allow these young people to have a fresh start in growth, a fresh start in education, and a fresh start in a new life. Aren't you? Thank you.
There's so much hurt and misery in the world. You can do so much with a little bit of effort. And that's what the coalition is all about. A little bit of money, a little bit of time, a great deal of effort, and we can absolutely eliminate these neglected tropical diseases that afflict 1 billion of the poorest of the poor of our society. What better cause can there be?
Thumbs up.
In 8 days, 5 million people we were able to deworm and vaccinate.